Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. This week, I'm talking to Alan Stamford, an actor and director and a teacher and artistic director, about the training he received at the Guildhall in the 1960s. Perhaps one of the less explored periods of actor training. So it's a really interesting conversation, actually. I was really thrilled with how it went. So sit back or keep doing whatever it is you're doing and enjoy this conversation with Alan Stamford about his theatre training at the Guildhall School of Acting in the 1960s. Thanks for listening. Great. The reason why I wanted to talk to you, Alan, really, is I've been haunted by something you once said to me that I don't know if we've ever talked about this. I mean, actually, we haven't talked for maybe 20 years or something. It's been a while.
Not quite that long, but close.
Yeah, not well.
Yeah, it is, actually, when you think about it.
It's, you're right. My son Robin is 17, and he was born when I was away in London. And I came back and did the Jane Eyre with you, so it's probably 17 years, something like that.
My God.
Still a wee while. But I remember...
Weird.
Yeah, time is it's endlessly fascinating, isn't it? It's an extraordinary thing. But I remember you saying about training, and we'll talk in a minute about where you trained, and that's part of what I want to talk to you about. But I remember you saying something to me. You said that you and Bob O'Mahony had been trained for a rep system that no longer existed, him at Lambda and you at the Guildhall. And I sort of, you know, people say things in a rehearsal or when you're chatting and you accept it and you sort of think about it. And I started wondering as the years went by quite what that meant. And then one day I was at Lambda and somebody had just put in the staff room, like it was a kind of a store cupboard, a filing system. And I went through the filing system and it was student records from people. From the 1960s and 70s. And I had a vague memory of Bob talking about the World Cup and being at Lambda during the World Cup. So I just checked around the dates and I found his sort of payment details from his discretionary grant. And so I was just sort of thinking recently about the training you had, the training Bob would have had, what their training was, and really what you meant. So that's my point of departure, is what did you mean when you said that you were trained for a rep system that was coming to an end or no longer in existence?
Yeah, it was a conversation I had both with Bob O'Mahony and also with John Dateen. Mm-hmm. Because John and Robert were friends at one point, and I worked with John, and we realized that separately, it wasn't a threesome conversation, it was two twosome conversations. We realized separately that we had all trained at the same time, and John was at Drama Center at the same time, and the conversation occurred twice, the same conversation on this very topic, that we were trained for a kind of theatre that had ceased to exist by the time we graduated. Now, remember, back in those days, theatre courses were 2 or 3 years long. That was it. When I was at the Guildhall, it was a 2-year course. You didn't get degrees in it. You know, it was considered a craft and an art, not an intellectual pursuit. So in those days, we got, you know, certificates or something. But anyway, what we all realized in our various drama school trainings was that we had been prepared as repertory actors, given a broad base of, the usual, in our case, Stanislavski base. My acting tutor at Guildhall was a man called Edward Argent, who went on to run the theatre school in the Royal Scottish Academy. Stanislavski based, very much voice train based, very heavily voice train based, very heavily movement train based. You've got those three fundamental disciplines hammered into you over a 2-year period of how to move, how to speak, and how to act. And how to act over a broad spectrum. You were trained I suppose in a strange way, you were trained to be multi-purpose character actors. And there was always prejudice, of course, because there's always prejudice. It's a thing that's unavoidable in human nature. So there were one or two people who were clearly earmarked for leading players. But the majority of us were trained over this very broad spectrum of how to go to a theatre company and play seven different roles over a period of 12 to 15 weeks. That was it, repertory acting. But by the time we graduated, you know, and that was in the late 60s, the whole repertory structure was beginning to fall apart. Companies were no longer employing actors for a long season. Suddenly, there was A, more money. The Labour governments of the late 60s had released more money for the arts. Regional theatres were stopping being repertory theatres and were becoming regional theatres. There was a new growth. There was a new interest. There was, I think, more money because more and more actors were employed for a play rather than a season. And therefore, you could be more type specific in terms of casting. You weren't looking for the repertory actor. You were looking for the actor specific to the role. So what we were trained for, what we were prepared for, wasn't quite what happened by the time we graduated. Ironically, on that very topic, I read a piece, I think it was in American Theatre Magazine. I've always advocated company theatre. I've always been a great passionate believer in it. And for 33 years at the Gate Theatre, Michael Colgan, when he was running it, advocated that concept of you maintain a family of actors. You may bring people in and out. But we, the family of actors at the Gate, was exactly that. We were repertory actors and played a multitude of roles and things. It died out in America. The last of the great old-style repertory theatres in America was probably Steppenwolf in Chicago. But I read recently in American Theatre Magazine that how the theatre will survive COVID and the lockdowns and people's nervousness and fear of traveling and all the rest of it is that repertory theatre may be on the way back. Hmm. I'm very glad to hear it because I never let it go.
Hmm. Yeah. So that's brilliant. So that all makes sense. So you were specifically trained to have a skill set that was not needed anymore because the theatre culture was changing, the way that people were employed, the kinds of plays people did and the length they did them for. But this is where my confusion lay. Do you think that having acquired those skills, having learned to do that, although the thing itself shifted, do you think you were then ill-equipped to do to work in the industry that you landed in?
Not ill-equipped, just ill-prepared, I suppose. Our training was really good. It was very intense. It was 2 years of incredibly intense training. So if you wanted to learn fencing, you had to be in there at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Friday. If you weren't in there at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Friday, you weren't in the fencing class. And if you missed two, you weren't in the fencing. You know, so they were trying to focus your mind on the fact the theater was incredibly hard work, incredibly disciplined, and you must follow that discipline. I fortunately did. And I think I've said to you years ago, I went to theater school with all the grace of a pregnant rhinoceros. I did every movement class they would let me do. And it paid off because in spite of the fact I'm 6'4" and shall we say bulky, I did end up with incredibly good movement control, which surfaced in many of the performances I gave and surprised people. So the training, the actual physical training, the craft that we were given was phenomenally beneficial. We were taught to be able to do anything that was thrown at us. The fact that we were no longer the kind of, the job spectrum was no longer a 12-week or a 15-week or a 6-month season was irrelevant to that. It was the fact whatever job you got, you were ready to go and do it. But And it certainly paid off for me because I changed countries. I went to Ireland for one season and stayed forever. I keep doing that. I'm here in America for one season, and 10 years later, I'm still running a theatre company here. But I think that the fundamental training that I got, that discipline in the craft, at the crafts of theatre, made it possible for me to have the kind of career that I have. It was not role-specific. It was craft-specific. So you weren't training to play Hamlet. You were training to play Shakespeare. You weren't, you know, training to be a leading man. You were training to be a general all-purpose, all-round actor who could tackle anything that was thrown at him because you had that craft built into you. Mm. And I like to use the word craft all the time. The craft of acting, I mean, I use it as one of the mottos for our own company, celebrating the craft of classic theater. I haven't been involved in theater training for 20 years now, since basically. And now I'm more conscious of it here in Pittsburgh, where we have a huge amount of theater and a huge amount of theater training. And I'm deeply conscious of the fact that I don't believe people are trained that way anymore.
So tell me, let's go back. So you were on the Isle of Wight, is that right, before you went off to drama school?
Yes, I grew up on the Isle of Wight. Mm-hmm. It wasn't where I was born, mm-hmm. but it was where I grew up. Uh-huh. And I was very fortunate in that I had a school teacher who noticed that in spite of the fact that I was fundamentally incompetent at just about everything, I could act. So he encouraged that, and that's how I became an actor.
And so you am I right in thinking you were 17 or 18 or quite young when you went up to London?
I was very young. I myself and another guy, still in London, still writing plays, called Paul Prescott. We were the two youngest there. I was 17 and a half when I went to Guildhall.
Wow.
I was very young. Why they took me, I do. Well, I know why they took me. Because my acting teacher, Edward Arch, actually there's a side story about that as well, to do with training, told me a long time afterwards that the only reason I got in was that I was the only person on that day of auditions who made him laugh. Okay. I remember my audition speech was the Gobbo speech, the conscience speech. But I was the only person that day who made him laugh. In fact, I was the only person that day who entertained him at all. So I got in. But I was way too young. I was far too young. And I came from a small community living on the Isle of Wight. I had no experience, no knowledge. The only thing I'd done was act in school because of this particular teacher who spotted that I could do it. So it was a bit of a shock for me and rather frightening.
Yeah.
And lonely. But I loved being part of the process of learning how to act. I loved doing it. I don't think I did it very well. In fact, I think I was really bad, but I absorbed it. Mm. And most important thing, I suppose, that I continued to absorb it after I had finished. You know, you can't learn it in 2 years. I remember the principal of the Guildhall, the drama side of it at that time, was a guy called Eric Capon. And he gave us a piece of advice. I remember him, I think it was his opening speech. And it went something like, you are now entering a tunnel, the end of which you will not see. No, the light at the end of which you will not see until at least 10 years after you've left. Was exactly right that it was not. I've tried to explain it to young actors now. It is not that you are learning about acting. We're not teaching you to act. We're teaching you all the things you need to go out and learn. We're giving you the shopping list. Now go out and develop it. And I suppose good training for theatre, that's what that's all about. It reminds me of the story of Edward Argent, that when we were finished after my 2 years, he was very concerned that I would never have a career as an actor and thought that I should do lighting design or stage management. I was a terrible stage manager. I wasn't a bad lighting designer. So I said, thank you very much, and I went off very depressed. About 25 years later, at the Edinburgh Festival, we were presenting Salome from the Gate Theatre. I was playing Herod. I'm sitting in the Lyceum Theatre, number one dressing room, taking off my white face, and the knock comes on the door. And I say, come in, and the door opens, and this bearded face comes round the door and says, and I looked at it, and I went, Edward Argent, you were wrong.
Yeah.
And he nodded and said, yes, I was. Can I buy you dinner?
Nice.
But it was. But the point about that story, which was very satisfying, is that he was right. That by the time I left Guildhall, I was not ready to be an actor. But what I had been given were the rubrics, the list, the shopping list of all the things I needed to do and develop. And that's what good training should be about. It's not anything that's esoteric. It is about putting a structure into the way your mind, your imagination, and your body functions to create character.
Yeah,
my theory.
No, I think you're probably right. I was watching with my son. We were watching Waiting for Godot, the Beckett on film production, the famous Walter Asmus production, which I've watched.
There's you there.
I know, which is a wonderful production, and I often think about it. Partly because I think about Johnny quite a lot, actually. He pops into my head from time to time, and I remember we were working together with Stephen and I think Johnny. Doing something when you guys went off to make that film. I remember having a pint with Stephen and he was heading off. It may even have been Jane Eyre. Would it have been that time?
No, we were doing Oliver Twist.
Oliver Twist, there you go. We were
doing Oliver Twist, and you were giving your Bill Sykes.
I was giving my Bill Sykes. There we go. There's one of the theatrical highlights.
Beating poor Fiona to death with your stick.
That's right. A piece of cabbage behind a box, I seem to remember.
All the old repertory tricks.
Yeah, was that an old repertory trick?
Oh yeah, yeah. When you want the sound of a skull being smashed in, you beat a red cabbage. Because bits that fly up look like bits of bloody skull.
If you get the lighting right. Yeah, there you go. That's that link. So I was watching that and I was thinking, wow, you know, you're, and I remember thinking this also watching you as Lady Bracknell, one of the last things I saw you do, I think. And being well aware of your physical skills, and also once you did something in a rehearsal for King Lear, and I might ask you to do a bit of King Lear later. I think I did mention that to you, but you were talking to the actor playing Edmund, who I think was Simon O'Gorman, and talking about the "Thou nature art my goddess" speech, and you did a really beautiful thing, imagining an ant crawling on your hand. And obviously, you were my director, so I was sort of grumpy with you about various things. So I didn't tell you how brilliant I thought it was. But I thought it was amazing what you did. Can we talk about that part of your training? Because you've mentioned having the grace of a rhinoceros, or what was your line?
A pregnant rhinoceros.
A pregnant rhinoceros, and there you are, somebody who's possessed, I'd say, of considerable skill. And I know Berkoff. I read one of Berkoff's autobiographies, and he speaks about that production of Salome in the Gate and mentions having a very skillful, excellent Herod. What was your training? What did you do at the Guildhall to transform you from that pregnant rhinoceros?
That's a very good question, because when I say we did a huge amount of movement work, it wasn't single focus, it was multifocus. Mm-hmm. So we did a class twice a week that we would now call aerobics. But it was a sort of combo aerobics and jazz. Mm-hmm. It was about rhythm and building up strength, building up flexibility. So that was one set of movement. We also did something that was the second thing, which we did once a week, would be somewhere closer to yoga, but not quite. Mm-hmm. It was run by a man called Ernst Burke, who may be one of the cruelest human beings I've ever come across when it came to training actors, because when he said, sit down, cross your legs, put your head on the floor, if you didn't do it, he'd stand on your back until you did. So it was a kind of forced development of opening up the body. Mm-hmm. of a lab, because, you know, one of the reasons most people can't move is because their body is locked into itself. That notion of opening out. I mean, I haven't done it in years, but I can still do it, is the weird thing. Because once your body has moved into a certain mode, no matter how old you are yet, and I am now considerably old, I can still do a lot of it. My balance isn't what it used to be. That's one of the curses of age. But the flexibility is still there. So between those two classes, our bodies were opened out. We learned rhythm. We learned shape. We learned filling space. Then the third field was that we had a class in what was described as period movement, which has nothing to do with menstruation. We learned every dance imaginable from primitive farandole all the way to the modern waltz, through the Viennese waltz, through the minuets, through everything. We learned them all. And our teacher was, what was her name? Stephanie something. She did a huge amount for the BBC, all those period things at the time. She was the choreographer. And she was incredible. So we were taking all the physical things that we had been learning and added that into an understanding of the nature of dance. And dance is merely rhythmic movement. It is movement to a set of steps. It is an expressive form of movement. I took a few additional classes in classic French ballet as well. I was never going to be a dancer. You know the size and shape of me. But what it did give me was a control over the physicality. So when you come back to that story about, and I remember the moment when you said it, of getting an actor taking a speech, taking a speech and turning it into a thought pattern, which is really what it's about. That if you are treating it like a soliloquy, playing it to the audience, you are going to tend to overpace it, overpresent it. Whereas if you can center it in upon itself and use your own physicality, examine your own hand as if there was an ant crawling over it and backwards and forwards while you're talking, then you suddenly have a point of focus for the words and for the expression that the audience can focus into. You're not doing something grandiose. You're doing something simple that is a thought process. When I directed the last Hamlet, I did with Marty Ray, and we talked about, you know, the inevitable famous soliloquy. I mean, how do you start it? Where do you do it? What do you do it? And he was still carrying. I've got him to keep carrying the book that Polonius saw him with. What do you read, my lord? Words, words, words. Keep carrying the book so that he's looking at a page in the book and saying, to be or not to be? That's the question. As if the question came out of the book, not out of ether. Finding points where you're using your own physicality, your own body, your own space, to focus and center the thought, because that's how thought always begins. When one does suddenly have a pure thought, it usually comes out of a moment of stillness within yourself or a moment of simple action within yourself. That was the point.
Mm. That's wonderful. Thank you. And so those three things you were working on. And so what year are we in? What year did you go to the Guildhall?
I'm trying to remember now. 66.
66, and that's an interesting year, isn't it? So the East 15 started up, the Drama Centre has started, obviously you mentioned that before. The Old Vic School has closed, so various experiments have been going on. Do you think that the training you received, did you have an awareness? Did people talk about things? Did the school describe a place in the history, or was it a sort of a random collection of clever folk with things to offer?
I think it was more the latter. Certainly the teachers were very, very high quality. Mm-hmm. I remember my own voice teacher, Roland Hill, was the most beautiful voice I've ever heard on anybody, but a remarkably skilled teacher. I don't think we were too aware of what was going on outside the circle of our training, because the training was so intense. And It was a different world. There was no social media as such. What news you got was gossip or the newspapers. So what was going on in other places? I remember the only student thing that we all got riled up about was when, what's his name, Terry Thing, Students' Union at the London School of Economics.
Tariq Ali, is that that time?
Tariq Ali, yeah. And there was a big sit-in, and then we read that because there was an impasse, the students all withdrew to the college bar. And the thing that angered us most was that they had a bar. we were less socially aware. And it was also London in the middle of the 60s. Mm. So even though I was young, there were other delights to be found.
Yeah, okay.
Of dubious form. So we weren't, there was no, I don't think there was any real sort of political sense with the small p of training and art and what have you, or awareness. When you're in the middle of a major upheaval, and as you say, in a sense it was at that point in the 60s, you're not aware of being in the upheaval. It's only outside that you see it, or in hindsight. And yeah, it was a time of change. But as I say, that very change was that very point I made that you brought up, that the world had changed, economics had changed, Wilson's government had changed the focus on the arts in terms of budget and politics, but you don't see it until it's long past.
Mm. And you chose? Did you choose the Guildhall? Did you apply to other schools? Could you tell us about?
I applied to Guildhall, Lambda, and Rada, uh-huh. And I didn't do the Lambda audition. I did the Rada audition. I did the Guildhall. I think Rada was going to take me as well, but Guildhall was much more attractive for the simple reason that back in those days, this will depress people. Back in those days, the fees for Lambda and Rada were £110 a term.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was a lot of money back in those days, when the average industrial wage was about £8 a week. But it was very cheap. Guildhall was subsidized by the City of London. I mean, the actual city, because it was in the city.
Yeah.
And the Lord Mayor's Fund subsidized Guildhall. Now, Guildhall was not just a drama school. It was a major music school, and still is, both. The Guildhall School of Music was phenomenal, and its opera course was huge. So it was subsidized by the city. So therefore, the fees, which were sort of bog standard throughout the major drama schools, were subsidized by 50%. Therefore, my fees were only £55 a term.
Mm.
So I went there. Mm. I was lucky, because at the time, and I shouldn't say this, but at the time, what was often described as the premier theatre school, we won't name it, but even though it has four initials, was more like a Swiss finishing school at that stage. The teaching wasn't great. The students weren't great. The output wasn't great. It was just not good. I was lucky that when I went to Guildhall, the teaching was terrific.
Mm.
And it varies. It's true of anything. A government is only as good as the ministers in it. A drama school is only as good as the teachers that are in it, which is a dilemma that somewhere close to your heart is going through at the moment. So going to any drama school can be luck of the draw. I was very lucky in the quality of teachers that I had. They may not have thought much of me, but my God, they gave me a very good training.
Mm-hmm. How many of you were there in the year? Do you remember?
There were two classes. I think there were, oh God, how many were there? I can't remember. I want to say sort of the number 22 comes to my head, but whether there were 22 in each class or two classes of 11, I can't remember. It wasn't huge. It was big. It wasn't huge. Some people dropped out at the end of the first year.
Did people get thrown out? Could you be chucked out?
You could be chucked out,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You could be chucked out. I survived, work by some miracle. Who else was there in my time? Barbara Flynn was there with me, who's done quite well. That I played Pierre Bezukhov to her Natasha in a college production of War and Peace. Never played that again. I think I was given the role because the first line of Pierre Bezukhov in the play is, Pierre Bezukhov, tall and stout, as you can see, with glasses. So I think that was a typecast. Right there. Anyway, but yeah, I can't remember the exact number.
But not 100 and not 6.
Oh, no, not 100, not 6. I think it was somewhere, I would comfortably say somewhere between 15 and 25.
Okay, so that's kind of similar to the posh schools now. They tend to have something around 28, something like that.
I think more than that in any given year, and you're not able to. I mean, it's the same. Teaching is teaching, no matter what you're doing, and whether you're teaching a primary school of infants to a school of potential actors, if you do not have enough time to pay attention to each student, then they are not getting the benefit of your teaching. And once you go above a certain number, you can't do it. Mm. I think 25 in a class is as many as you should ever have. Mm.
Do you know the actor David Timpson? Has David ever entered your
David who?
David Timpson. He's a wonderful voice actor. He does an awful lot of Naxos audiobooks, and he's a tutor at RADA and an actor.
I haven't met him. No.
You'd like him. He might be. He's also a Guildhall actor, and there are things that remind me of you and him, and him and you. One of which is the voice. So, could you talk us through your voice training? Where did you get that voice from? Is that from?
That's a very good question. That's an excellent question, because when I went to drama school, as you pointed out, I came from I'd grown up on the Isle of Wight. And so if there was a vowel to swallow, I would swallow it.
What is an Isle of Wight accent? Can you do it?
It's like Hampshire, but Isle of Wight is much more further back in the throat. So you're actually bringing your vowels right back down into your throat. You could eat them. Mm. You could live on them. So, and my voice was much higher. So this voice is not my voice. This is the voice of Roland Hill, who gave it to me. Mm. He taught me. I mean, it's everything you know and understand about voice training in the old school. I don't believe in the term old fashioned. Old school, and old school is a wonderful phrase, and I really do believe in it. He taught us how to breathe. And until we could breathe, he would not let us utter a sound. And it was literally weeks of breathing, 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 until the rib cage had learned to do its job, until we were back to breathing the way we did when we were tiny babies, which is expanding the diaphragm and contracting the diaphragm. And taught us that simple thing. Watch a baby sitting up straight. It will sit with its back straight and it will breathe with its diaphragm. So that was the primary thing. All noise comes from breath. There is a teacher I shan't name here in Pittsburgh who keeps ranting on about the sound travels on the thought. No, it doesn't. It travels on the breath. We learnt old-fashioned phonetic construction of creating sounds, of lingua palatal exercises, placing the tongue, opening the mouth, using all the resonating chambers of the body properly, isolating each one of them, working each one of them, using lingua palatal exercises, old school, not elocution, because we had gone beyond the days when the rank charm school way of speaking, RP, in all those wonderful movies, that had gone, but using lingua palatal exercises to the point at which your mouth ached. But I remember him saying one day, he said, if you ever watch a young dancer learning to dance on point and the cruelty it inflicts on the feet, That's what we need to get in your mouth. Your mouth has got to become, now it isn't anymore. My mouth doesn't have the flexibility, nor does my voice have the range. But thanks to him, learning how to use tone, learning how to place sound, the mechanics, the craft, I keep coming back to that, the craft of voice. I did at one point, I mean, when we did Salome, Roger Doyle, who was you know, doing the music and things, pointed out to me that in my first line of dialogue, I achieved 3 octaves.
Mm, amazing.
Over three words, 4 syllables.
Oh, go on. Managed. Can you still?
Oh, I can't do it.
No, not the four.
Where
not-
is Salome? Mm. And no, it's not very pure anymore because I'm old. But that ability, that's not some God-given gift. That was hard, bloody work on the part of my voice tutor back in the 60s. Mm. To have that degree of range, some people are lucky. They're born with a basso profundo voice or a high tenor voice. But to actually develop a range, to give yourself 3 octaves of voice, is hard, bloody work. But if you do it, the potential that you have as an actor is enormous, because suddenly you can put into the audience's head noise that moves them just with your voice. Noise affects us. I wonder we use the word noise, not sound. Sound sounds terribly mechanical. It's the noise that we make. We make noises. And it is by the distribution of that noise and by the emotion behind that noise, or how that noise expresses an emotion within the mind of the audience. That's how a play works. That's how a character works. That's how we work as human beings. You know, you walk up to the young lady of your dreams and you say, hello. It's not really impressive. But if you walk up and go, they're going to be more interested. And that's noise. It's not even word.
Yeah, no, I see. Is there anything, so this voice, extraordinary thing that you have and that you can use to affect people, do you ever miss anything that you lost? I mean, when you said earlier that this voice is not mine, it was given to me by, I thought that was fascinating. Is there any part of you that ever, sort of almost like Orson Welles in Citizen Kane, is there any little sort of moment for you when you look back and regret or miss things about yourself?
No, not at all. I don't want to do the old romantic story of I was always good, but as I looked out at the snow falling here in Pittsburgh, you know, where's my rosebud? I don't think there is anything that I. Here's the point. I don't think I lost anything. Mm-hmm. I just think what they did was build on what I was and what I had. And that's the point. You don't make an actor. You develop the craft within the actor. And a craftsman can only use whether you're learning to be a blacksmith or an electrical engineer or a computer, you can only use what you have. If you're going to work with your hands, it's these hands that you have. Nobody can give you a new set of hands. The same is true of an actor. I was never going to be a Romeo. I was 6'4" and chunky. The one thing he did do was give me a much deeper voice, because he made me breathe. Instead of talking through my head, I was talking through my chest. That voice was always there. All they did was release it. But I was never going to be a romantic, although I did play one or two romantic leads, now I think about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, well, Valmont, not really romantic.
Sexy.
Sexy? Oh, yes, I was sexy immediately. But, no, I don't think there's anything that I lost. I think, and I don't think anybody ever does. No matter how much you transform, no matter how much you grow and develop, you are growing and developing and transforming on the palette that is the essential you. I certainly don't miss the way I used to speak.
Okay, good. So that's the voice training and the movement training. And the thing that surprised me a little bit was that you mentioned Stanislavski as part of the acting training. And I mean, legend has it, or the pattern that's often presented is that no one did an acting class until they started them in the drama center in 1964. And then that slowly spread out. And famously, they didn't do a sort of an acting class explicitly in RADA until the 1980s. Which is a sort of fascinating fact. There's truth in that. So what, when you studied acting, what did you study? What were you working with? Who taught you?
Well, as I say, my main acting tutor was Edward Argent, and was not a bad director either. But it was Stanislavski. It was not method. It was, we studied through Stanislavskian techniques. So when you read the books, you know, An Actor Prepares and the rest of them, and the kind of exercises that Stanislavski was advocating, mm-hmm. that fundamentally was what we were doing. We did do a huge amount of improvisational work and role-playing and game-playing. To my best memory, I don't think we did a vast amount of text analysis mm-hmm. in that pure sense of sitting down in a room and analyzing a text. We did read scripts and things, but most of the work was engaged in the process of improvisation around loose themes and very often with no set objective, mm-hmm. certainly in the early period. Here's a set of guidelines, off you go. And I used very similar techniques when I was teaching 30 odd years ago, of setting up a proposition and letting, because what you're looking for, I suppose, is how the individual actor's imagination is prepared to open up, how the inhibition is removed. Mm-hmm. So I'm surprised. I'd forgotten, or maybe I'm surprised that RADA wasn't teaching acting per se until the 80s, because we were certainly doing it in the 60s.
Well, an acting class directly related to, I mean, Doreen Cannon was the teacher at Drama Centre. So, of course, people have always done, I mean, improvisation was a big part of Saint-Denis schools in the pre-war and post-war. Yeah. So I wonder how much that had probably filtered out. Could you?
I think it had filtered out. And I think that Teddy Argent was an exponent. We also did, I mean, there were interesting classes that happened. For instance, one of our movement teachers, Andrew Rollo, I can't remember, and the aforementioned Roland Hill, we did a voice and movement class, which we did a six-week period. There was an hour and a half set aside where we would go in. It was ostensibly a movement class, but while we were adding vocalization in, so that vocalization became an expression of motion. That's not a very good description of it, but I think you get what I mean.
It makes sense to me. Completely.
And it was useful because, as I say, because these were the rubrics that were being imprinted in the brain that we would later suddenly, you know, you're in rehearsal 10 years later and you go, oh, that's what they meant. Get it. But you've also been prepared for those discoveries, that somewhere in that training process, there is a sort of, it's about, you know, a bit like looking at a book and seeing the reference number to turn to the back page, that as you're going through your career, if you've been well trained, you've got reference points to go back. You don't have everything, of course not. No theater school can possibly train everybody for every eventuality that's going to turn up in their career, but the fact that once in my life I had done enough work in terms of movement, vocal control and discipline and improvisational imagination to be able to walk onto the stage of the Irish National Theatre and play Lady Bracknell was quite something. And I could only, not because I'm brilliant, but because I had the craft and the skill base to enable me to do it. all of that comes, I think, from, and you see, your training is not what you get in theater school. Your training is what you do with what you get in theater school, how you utilize that knowledge, how you utilize that, as I say, that set of rubrics that is presented to you. These are the things you're going to need to learn as you progress. That's the point. Acting wise, we did have, looking back on it, I think I won't say revolutionary, but certainly quite a new take on the old rules of Stanislavski. But it was not remotely connected, not really in any sense to the Lee Strasberg school of thinking.
So can you remember or give an example of an improvisation, how it was set up and what happened within it? Could you take us? I know it's obviously
I think it was during the second year. I remember because I'd done this one with students as well, and you can take it as anything you like, but when you've got your group of students and you want to have a big group improvisation, and don't forget all of us were experienced at the notion of improvisation at this stage. But it was about how you relate to a set of rules about your own character, about who you are. And it was a story build. So the idea was two families at a wedding, family of the groom, family of the bride, and you would allocate particular roles, you know, father of bride, father, you know. But you would give characteristics. You would say, this is the family drunk. This is the bridesmaid who used to go out with the group. You have all of those things set up, set of rules, and you have them write down, who am I, and know who they are. And then you set up an improvisation to run from the moment the bride and groom have just left. What happens then? So that they all walk back into the room and start conversation. And the exercise is not how funny it can be or how clever it can be, but how well you can represent those particular traits that you have been given as a member of this group. It's about not simply about improvisation, but control of character. Not go out of character, to stay within the bounds, within your imagination, to stay within the bounds that the script, if you like, set up for you. It was an interesting exercise, and I've used it myself. But you don't do that with a group of newbies. You do that when people have got used to the notion. I mean, we did exercises, and I've used them myself because they're fairly bog standard. You tell each student, tomorrow I want you to come in and I want you to be yourself, but 5 years older or 5 years younger or 10 years younger or 10, you know, whatever. I want you to come in as pick a profession and we're going to talk to you. And if you don't know what you're talking about, we're going to expose you.
I was going to ask about professions, things like that. So that did you ever do observing real people or going out into a market?
Yeah. I remember saying, in terms of Dublin, and it's true of London or any city, but in terms of Dublin, I would always say to my students, every character you will ever play in the whole course of your career is on Grafton Street in Dublin right now. All you have to do is go out and find them. I said, you know, Juliet's out there and Lady Bracknell's out there and King Lear is out there. They're all there on that street. So I would send them out as an exercise to, designated time at exactly 10 o'clock in the morning. The first person you see, follow them. Follow them for an hour and watch them and observe them and learn everything about them and then come back and represent them.
And was that something you did specifically as part of your training?
No, yes, not quite that. We were told to follow people. Just to watch walking and how people moved and how people, you know, that kind of thing. We would also, because Guildhall at the time was on John Carpenter Street, just beside Blackfriars. So up on Fleet Street behind us was the Royal, the Courts of Justice, where all the civil cases were heard. So we would be told, when you're free, because you go up Ludgate Circus and up Ludgate Hill and you were at Old Bailey, go to the courts, watch the barristers. You know, another good method of training. watching and observing. I think it's one of the particular gifts. You know, if an actor is gifted, one of the things they're gifted with is observation. Alec Guinness always talked about it when he was building a character. The first thing you would get would be the walk. When he knew how the character walked, he could start building out from that. Every actor's got some point. Where does this start from? About 4 years ago, I played Henry in The Lion in Winter. The starting point from that was the realization that time was stopping me from doing what I always used to do quite easily. Let's not go into details, but that realization, the physicality of age, yeah. And that was the starting point. And observation is the key. And we were taught, look and learn. When you see, when whatever character you seek is out there on the street, go and look for them. Mm. Go and look for their physicality. Mm. Because physicality is merely a representation of what's going on inside.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that's very true and insightful. When it came to making things, so did you do radio? Did you do some telly? Did you do three shows in the final year? Did you do a musical? What was the actual sort of repertoire of showings as you moved into production?
We did. There was a major production each term. Mm-hmm. And we were blessed with the fact that we had this beautiful theatre, now gone. They pulled it down. But it was a beautiful little 450-seat opera house because, of course, the opera course was the major user of it. Mm-hmm. And but that gave us an awful lot of additional experience. And as I mentioned, I was well thought of for my lighting design. And, in fact, I lit Figaro. And the relatively young Alan Opie was Figaro in that. He was a student there at the time. There were a few others that were there on the music course. What's his name? Who made an awful lot of money singing very old-fashioned songs. Peter Skellern?
Oh, that rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, him. He was there at that time, too.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of opportunity for the hands-on practice of theatre. We had student productions. A major production. So it was a student production every term. There was a major production every term.
A student production that you did yourself, you made yourselves?
Yeah, we had a scene day where first time I ever directed anything was Pirandello's Man with the Flower in His Mouth.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Who was Sidney Livingstone, who spent most of his life with the Royal Shakespeare, and Adrian Shergold went on to be a director. He directed, remember that movie of about the hangman? Him, with Timothy Spall. Yeah, Adrian directed that. So we had a lot of opportunity to be literally feet on stage. Every term a scenes day, every term a student production, every term a major production. And War and Peace being one of them, and I ended up playing Pierre Bazoukov. We would do Shakespeare usually once a year. The opportunities to actually practice the craft were given to us. But not some schools, I think, tend to do too much in terms of official productions. Learning to act is not about acting. Learning to act is learning about the craft. Putting that into practice should be controlled and conditioned, because there's no point in constantly doing it if you're not doing it right, you're not doing it well. So some of the productions were good, some of them weren't. One of the tutors directed a production of Romeo and Juliet. I fortunately only had to play Peter, servant to the nurse.
It's a great role.
Oh, it's a great role. It's a fabulous role. I got my first agent who saw me playing that. She refused to cut one single word.
Mm.
Did you know that if you do the entire Romeo and Juliet, it's 5.25 hours long?
Is that true? That's brilliant. That's very funny.
Oh, my God. It was agony. Agony.
Did they do the two hours traffic? Did somebody say that at the top?
Yes, yes. And then there was one totally irrelevant, but anyway, there was one on, I think it was the last night, the actor playing the prince suddenly got a belt of food poisoning halfway through the show. I mean, he literally couldn't walk on. So another actor walked on at the end and said, the epilogue of, you know, it's a very gloomy morning tomorrow and the sun won't shine. So let's go away and talk about it, because there hasn't been as sad a story as this of Romeo and Juliet. I mean, it was the most cock-up of... Yes, it was fun. Yeah. We had fun.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'd like to ask you two things before we finish. The first one is there any particular experience or teacher or rehearsal or thing anyone said to you, something that stayed with you or still works on you, something you got from your training? I'm curious.
It was a very long time ago. I think there was no specific thing. I mean, you know, no epiphany moment.
Mm-hmm.
Being told, do this and you shall rule the world. There was nothing like that. I think I was brought, I mean, to my mind, the most important thing that was given to me in theatre school was not so much the acting classes, although they were important, not diminishing anything, but the realization that I had a much bigger, broader, more expressive voice than I ever realized. And that I could, within me was the power to move. I mean, I think it was voice and movement that shaped the kind of actor I became. The realization that I could, having grown up, feeling awkward. I mean, as a child, always feeling awkward. As a child, never vocally expressing myself. There are a lot of complex reasons about that as well, you know, because, you know, I'm a lunatic. But the childhood suppression of physicality and vocality was suddenly released by theatre school. Completely opened up in me, and a realization that when I opened my mouth, I could make sounds that made people listen. That discovery was really, really vital to me. I can't remember any particular phrase or conversation that was focused on that, but I was constantly being given the confidence to go that step further with both movement and with the voice, and that changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. That's wonderful. And then the last thing I wanted to ask you, and you can say no, of course. I think I mentioned that we're big fans of King Lear in this house, and I've often told my son about your Lear, and I remember you telling me about watching Timothy West and particularly it's the bit after Bear Free and Patient Thoughts, the bit after Dover Beach, that section of Lear, those extraordinary speeches of his. And I was wondering if you would be so kind as to do a bit of your Lear for us.
Can't remember it all. It's been a while since I played. Yeah, I did. I mean, Lear has a deep effect on people. And I think one is always deeply affected by the first Lear you witness. Uh-huh. And you mentioned Timothy West. I was very lucky. I got to direct him as Lear. And then I remember when we had our first sort of conversation on the topic, he said, "You must realize that I'm already deeply affected by a Lear." And I said, "Would it be Schofield's Lear with Peter Brook back in 1963, 64? And he said, "Yes, how do you know?" I said, "Because I saw it too, and I'm deeply affected by it." Mm-hmm. And I think one's first, and I remember Ian Holm went to play it at the National. I was talking to him about it because he worked with us at the Gate a lot. And for him, that also he was just a young actor with the Royal Shakespeare at the time watching. And he went on to do things like the Richard III and things. But watching Schofield playing that. Schofield was in his 40s when he played that Lear, you know? And it was extraordinary. And Diana Rigg as Cordelia, never forgot her. I saw Peggy Ashcroft and Elizabeth Spriggs as the other two. Brewster Mason as Kent. It's how long ago? 1963, but it stays. So Lear for me has always been a progression. I've now played it three times. I played it twice on stage and once on the radio. Oh. I've directed it three times. It's sort of part of my theatrical DNA now. It's, to me, the greatest play ever written, closely followed by Godot.
Cherry Orchard, would you put that? I always think those. Yeah,
Cherry Orchard, very high on the list. Very high on the list. I'm not as much of a Chekhovian, but very high on the list. But the thing about Lear as a character is I think Lear is life. And I think, well, first of all, I don't think that Shakespeare could have written Lear if he hadn't read Beckett first. But it is a total Beckettian journey of self-discovery for every character in it, or all the principal characters are on a journey of self-discovery all the way through the play, from Edmund at the beginning to realize his potential. From Edgar discovering how worthless everything is and how little he needs to survive. From Gloucester discovering truth, seeing the truth once his eyes were gone. Everybody's on this journey of the sisters discovering their own strengths and their own strengths. So that made the play to me a point of absolute fascination. And Lear discovering the true nature of manhood, one of the most beautiful, simple little speeches ever composed. Thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more but such a poor, bare-forked animal as thou art. Unaccommodated man. What a beautiful use of phrase. Unaccommodated man. Man with nothing. It's Shakespeare, just his language in this play is incomparable. The mad Lear on the heath is not mad. He is seeing. He is at his sanest in the mad sequence. You know, when he talks about the thief in front of the justice, change places, handy dandy, which is the justice, which is the thief. I can't remember all the words of it, so I'm not even going to try because I'll only screw it up. But
have you got a copy?
I have, actually.
Get a copy. I want you to do it. Go on, do it. Okay.
Hello, me here. Alan just pops off to find his copy of King Lear. He's returning now.
Now I've got to find the... I don't have a handy small copy, so you'll have to make do with my Oxford big one.
Perfect.
Searching. Where the hell is Lear? Do you know what? I saw last year a play I was up in Stratford, Ontario for the theatre festival there and saw a Shakespeare I haven't seen in 100 years and forgotten it's actually a very good play, which is Henry VIII, All Is True.
Yeah, Henry VIII's wonderful.
It's a very good play. I'd forgotten.
Edwardian. It's got that amazing scene between Anne Boleyn and the old lady, which I think is one of the most extraordinary scenes in Shakespeare. It's so modern. I mean, it's like you mentioned him reading Beckett. He'd obviously read Arthur Miller to write that one.
Yeah. It just goes to show how ahead of his time and how innovative and how deeply understanding of theatrical possibility Shakespeare was. It's quite amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. There's that amazing bit in Lear when he leaves Gloucester on stage. Do you remember? Edgar goes off and leaves Gloucester just sitting on stage saying nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
And then comes back and says the battle's over.
Yeah.
But he people talk about... it's my slightly crass comparison, but people sort of say, oh, Shakespeare. Yeah, I don't know. Shakespeare invented... I always maintained there were three points in theatre history. There was a lot of development, but there were three major points of change. The first was 2,500 years ago with Sophocles, who sort of defined how a play should work. And then you jump forward 2,000 years, and Shakespeare completely rewrites the rule book. And suddenly plays are not about kings and princes or kings and princes. It's not gods in their heavens, kings on their thrones, and peasants. You know, suddenly Shakespeare says everybody is human. Everybody is just a man. And a king, and Jan Kott's commentary on Shakespeare, I still think that book's wonderful, Shakespeare Our Contemporary. Wonderful, wonderful book. And I recommend it to everybody. That every character in Shakespeare is human. They're not supernatural. They are people. Even the supernatural, if you like, wizard of Prospero is just a grumpy, jealous old fart. They're human. And then the next great moment of change happened in 1949-1950 with Samuel Beckett, who didn't change theatre. He just brought it back to its essence and said what we're dealing with fundamentally is the truth of the human condition. And Godot is a perfect example of the truth of the human condition, which is why I say Lear and Godot. Yeah, you were mentioning a particular scene of Lear.
Well, if you would give us that treat, it's the section after Edgar says bear free and patient thoughts, and it's the section with I always love the way you did Clothier's Yard and but to the girdle do the gods inherit.
Oh yeah,
the rest is all the fiends. That section of the play, I just think is extraordinary language.
They cannot touch me for coining. I am the king himself. Nature's above art in that respect. There's your press money. That fellow handles his bow like a clothier's crow keeper. Call me a clothier's yard. Look, a mouse. Peas. This piece of toasted cheese will do it. There's my gauntlet. I'll prove it on a giant. Bring up the brown bills. Well flown, bird, in the clout. Ooh. Give the word. Goneril, with a white beard. They flattered me like a dog and told me I had white hairs in my beard ere the black ones were there. To say aye and no to everything that I say aye and no to was no good divinity. When the rain came to wet once and the wind to make me chatter, when the thunder would not peace at my bidding, there I found I could smelt them out. Go to, they're not men. Not men of their words. They told me I had everything. It's lie, not ague proof. And on.
Oh, no, that was wonderful. I want you to do more. That was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm going to do it one more time before I die. I'm quite determined.
Yeah.
I've taken an executive decision that life is far too short not to play Lear at least five times.
Yeah. So you say you did it on stage twice. So the production that I was in, was that your first Lear?
I did it three times.
Three times.
I did it when I was young as well.
Yeah, I think you'd already done it. And then I think you did one.
Yeah. My goodness me. There's a thing I'd forgotten. Forget me. It is the project. Of course I did. So, yes, I played it three times on stage, once on radio, and I've directed it a couple of times as well.
Radio for RTE?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, with Dan Reardon directed it. It's there. It's in the archive.
I'll find it.
Yeah. It wasn't bad. The only advantage was that when we recorded it, I went into the dead room to do the storm sequence. And you can only do it in one. And fortunately, I knew it. So on those rare occasions on radio where you just walk into, stand in front of a microphone, hear the storm going in your headphones, and go for it. Mm. Yes, that was quite an And there's another example of, you know, but for the craft of the voice, you couldn't play those games with the voice that it demands to play a Lear. It's not a matter of going out and shouting. There is such subtlety in those lines, such a range and such passion and such fear and such layering of emotion. Nobody can simply walk out onto a stage and do it. It's a bit like, I mean, it's the closest thing to opera in that sense. You do not sing a great operatic aria off the top of your head. The preparation, the range, the discipline. You know, when you listen to the great singers singing, I mean, there's a wonderful film that Placido Domingo made of Otello. And Domingo was one of those rare major opera stars who was really a wonderful actor as well. You listen to the singing in that. The newer range of opera stars are really, really, really wonderful actors. But it's not thrown together. It is part of a craft and a structure and a discipline that without which you are never ever going to truly embrace the totality of the potential of any text.
That's brilliant.
That's my message for the
day. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Thank you. Is there anything before we go and say goodbye you'd like to add or anything? You know, the French have that expression, the wit of the stairs, wit de l'escalier. Have you ever heard that expression?
Yeah.
When you suddenly realize the thing you wish you'd said afterwards, is there anything you want to add?
No, because I'm pompous enough to do my own webinar every Friday and for the wit and wisdom of Alan Stanford. But I prefer, on this particular topic, I think it was the apocryphal story about Casals, the cellist, who was still practicing daily at the age of 75. And someone said to him, "Why do you still keep practicing?" He said, "Because I think I'm beginning to get the hang of it."
Great.
That's my message to every actor.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. So that's the end of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alan Stanford. Alan was a really remarkable actor, a fine director, and still working away. So next week, I think maybe as a bonus episode, I'm going to release a history of East 15, a lecture that Jerry McAlpine gave to students of the MA acting course at East 15 last week, which I was allowed to record. And then following that, well, maybe a Christmas treat. I'm thinking of finally producing maybe several podcasts on the story of Frances Kelly, Fanny Kelly, and her theatre school on Dean Street, which would be a treat, a festive treat. Thank you so much for listening. I hope we have good weeks. Take care.